Today at Reader's Corner, Peter Stark, author of Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire, a story of wealth, ambition, and survival.
Astor came up with a scheme where he would start the first American colony on the West Coast. This colony, Astoria, was so much more remote than the first British colonies. Imagine being 25,000 miles from your base of operations in New York. Astor's men, in all their stumblings around through the mountains and the Snake River country, they found the route that ultimately became the Oregon Trail.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The rugged coastline of the Pacific Northwest is dotted with cities and seaports of historic interest, but today's well-established metropolises belie the imagination and tenacity that it took to settle this wild and remote region. In 1809, John Jacob Astor, a young, ambitious New York businessman, saw the potential of the Northwest coast as a great trading emporium for the western half of the United States. Astor dispatched a land party and a sea party that he hoped would make it to what is now Astoria, Oregon. The plan was to set up a Jamestown-like colony and to establish a fur trading empire. The explorers arrived, at least some of them did, but not without great peril. And as many grand schemes go, Astor's didn't exactly pan out. Peter Stark tells this fascinating tale in a new book titled Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire, a story of wealth, ambition, and survival. He is an adventure writer and longtime correspondent for Outside Magazine, as well as a contributor to many national publications and the author of several other books. Peter Stark will be visiting Rediscovered Books in downtown Boise on Thursday, September 18th, to talk about his latest book and sign copies. His presentation starts at 6 p.m., and you can find out more at rdbooks.org. Mr. Stark joins us by phone for this interview. Peter Stark, welcome to Reader's Corner.
It's great to be here, Bob.
Well, Peter, the John Jacob Astor that I remember in history is the guy who went down on the Titanic with his wife. And I wonder if you could help us understand the line of Astor's. As I understand it, the one you're talking about in your book would have been his great-grandfather. Is that about right?
His great-grandfather. I think maybe his great-great-grandfather.
Great-great-grandfather.
His great-grandfather.
And this is the guy who started it all, really.
The Astor I'm writing about is the patriarch of the whole line.
Right, right. I mean, there wouldn't be a Waldorf.
US and in England.
Yeah, there wouldn't be a Waldorf Astoria if it wasn't for
there
John
There would not
Jacob
be a Waldorf Astoria. And the interesting thing about the Waldorf Astoria is that the original patriarch, John Jacob Astor, was born in a small town called Waldorf, Germany.
Aha, I never knew that.
And the son of a butcher. And one of four brothers, and all his brothers went off to other parts of Germany. One went to London, and young John Jacob was apprenticing with his father, the butcher in Waldorf, and he finally left too after 2 years of apprenticing as a butcher and emigrated to the United States when it was a fledgling country. It was right after the Revolutionary War.
Uh-huh.
But that's how we get Waldorf Astoria is from
his Yes, hometown. And of course Astoria, Oregon, and let's start there. Tell us about his plan. What was he up to?
So, as we were just talking, he was a young German immigrant who'd come to the U.S. and right after the Revolutionary War, a very focused young businessman. He started trading furs in New York City, which was then a little, small port town, importing finely made musical instruments from London, exporting wild animal furs from North America, fur and music shop he had in Manhattan. He started trading furs up and down the Hudson Valley, then working with the Canadian traders in Montreal. And he eventually saw the possibilities of what the West Coast could be of North America. It was essentially unclaimed territory. Captain Cook had been exploring in the Pacific in the 1770s, and Cook's men had discovered you could buy a sea otter for the equivalent of $1 from the coastal Indians on Vancouver Island and sell it in China for the equivalent of $100. So this essentially set off a fur rush to the Northwest coast. Astor came up with a scheme, a grand scheme, where he would start the first American colony on the West Coast at the mouth of the Columbia River at what's now Astoria, Oregon. And it was a very, very well thought out. He was a meticulous planner. He would take trade goods from New York City, send them on his fleet of ships around the tip of South America, around Cape Horn, up to the mouth of the Columbia, his trade emporium, as he called it, trade with the coastal Indians for sea otter furs, and also establish a network of fur posts way up into the Columbia Basin, all the way deep into the Rocky Mountains. So establish all this huge network of fur posts in what was then unclaimed territory, and funnel all those furs, those, you know, the beaver furs, the bear, lynx, everything he could catch, down to the emporium at the Columbia's mouth, buy the sea otter furs, send those to China, trade those to the Chinese, huge profits. The Chinese mandarins used these furs to trim their robes, so there were huge profits to be made. Use that money to buy Chinese luxury goods, teas, silks, porcelains, and send those Chinese luxury goods the rest of the way around the world on his fleet of ships back to London and New York and sell them for huge profits. So he would be making profits at every stop. It was a trans-Pacific, trans-global trade. And he saw that possibility of the Pacific as a global center of trade, of commerce, long, long, long before most people did, before they started thinking of the West Coast.
And apparently President Thomas Jefferson did as well?
And Thomas Jefferson did as well, exactly. And Jefferson grew up in Virginia, son of a surveyor. And so Jefferson was very early as a young man looking towards the West and always thinking about the sweep of the continent towards the West. Of course, he was, you know, much responsible for the Louisiana Purchase in 1803 when he was president. He was president 1800 to 1808, bought the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, which extended U.S. territory to the crest of the Rocky Mountains. And then, of course, sent Lewis and Clark to find a route to the Pacific. They came back, Lewis and Clark did. Lewis said, well, we found a route to the Pacific, but it's really hard. It's you get a lot of mountains to cross. But what I do recommend, said Meriwether Lewis to Jefferson, is that the U.S. establish a seaport on the Pacific. And again, that was unclaimed territory. And just at that time, that was when Astor launched his idea and wrote Jefferson a letter, this is in 1808, to the president's house in Washington and said, look, I have a plan to capture most of the fur trade of North America and put it through our own hands. And in other words, take it out of the British hands, which Jefferson liked to do. So together they came up, they met in Washington in the summer of 1808. They brainstormed this enormous scheme. You can see how they fueled each other with their visions. Astor with this trans-global trade vision, and Jefferson actually saw this colony on the West Coast, this trade empire, to be as the beginnings of a separate country, like a sister democracy to the United States, which was then all on the East Coast. So it would plant the seeds of liberty and democracy on the West Coast, and liberty and democracy would spread from the West Coast across the continent to the East Coast. So whereas Astor had a commercial vision, Jefferson had a political vision of the continent.
Why the mouth of the Columbia River where Astoria, Oregon is today, as opposed to, let's say, Puget Sound or somewhere farther north along the coast of Washington?
Well, you and your listeners will have a good understanding of this. The mouth of the Columbia, if you're in Puget Sound, there are not many rivers you can go up very far into the interior of the continent. If you're at the mouth of the Columbia, you can paddle a canoe, a big trading canoe, upriver for hundreds and hundreds of miles in many directions, you know, including where, well, if you have to get through Hell's Canyon, that's an issue, but including to where you are in Boise, and it opens up an area the size of the Columbia Basin, you know, which is, I think it's about the size of France, the Columbia Basin itself, and mm-hmm. Astor's vision extended beyond the Columbia Basin, but mm-hmm. It gave him access to a huge transportation network, mm-hmm. the Columbia did.
Today we're talking about the book Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire, A Story of Wealth, Ambition, and Survival. My guest is Peter Stark, its author. So in order for him to pull this off, he had to get there a first time. And he decides that he's going to go by land and he's going to go by sea. let's do these one at a time. But tell us about the trip by sea. You mentioned going around Cape Horn. That just blew me away. I mean, obviously the Panama Canal wasn't there yet. So
the Panama Canal wasn't there, and that was the way to get to the West Coast. And it was, you know, it's unbelievable in our imagination. That was a 6-month voyage of 25,000 miles. That's the equivalent of going around the Earth at the equator. So that I like to remind people that this colony Astoria, which you know some people call the Jamestown of the West, was so much more remote than the first British colonies on the East Coast. You know, if you compare it to Jamestown or Plymouth, Jamestown and Plymouth were, I don't know, something like 3,000 miles across the Atlantic from England. Imagine being 25,000 miles from your base of operations in New York, months and months. So very remote. That whole area, that whole Pacific coast is unclaimed territory, essentially, from the crest of the Rockies to the Pacific. That's something we don't appreciate either, that no European power had really claimed that.
Right.
That Spanish were down in Mexico and a few fur posts of Russia up in Alaska. So Astor sent his expeditions around, the seagoing one around Cape Horn, to the mouth of the Columbia. The other party, the overland party, went on the Voyageur route through the Great Lakes, essentially, down the Mississippi River, and then up the Lewis and Clark route, meaning up the Missouri. And it was supposed to go over the, you know, follow the Missouri to the headwaters and cross the Rockies and then follow the Columbia down to the Pacific coast. Well, they altered route, and that made all the difference.
So they altered it intentionally?
They altered it intentionally. You know, basically Astor sent these two advance parties in 1810 to establish this outpost on the Pacific coast, you know, the beginnings of this great empire. So the overland party was led by a young New Jersey businessman named Wilson Price Hunt, who is a very serious-minded, consensus-seeking, well-liked guy, and it was a good businessman. His great drawback was he'd never been in the wilderness before, and yet he was leading a 60-person party across the wilds of the North American continent. So what happened is they got as far as St. Louis and started up the Lewis and Clark route, up the Missouri. Lewis and Clark had only come down the Missouri 5 years earlier. As Wilson Price Hunt and his party went up the Missouri, and it's a party of, you know, they're Scottish, expert Scottish fur traders, they're French-Canadian voyageurs, they're Indian interpreters, huge party. As they go up the Missouri, they start hearing worse and worse stories about the ferocity of the Blackfeet Indians at the headwaters of the Missouri in what's now Montana. And it turned out that Meriwether Lewis had actually killed two young Blackfeet and left a Jefferson Presidential Medal hanging around one of their necks. And the Blackfeet were still infuriated by this. So earlier white trappers had been going up the Missouri and had been getting massacred. So one day, as Hunt's party's going up the Missouri, they see a canoe coming down the Missouri in which are three white trappers. And the canoe pulls over, and they talk, and there's one of them in there, 60-year-old Edward Robinson, and he's just been one of the survivors of a Blackfeet massacre up way upriver. And Edward Robinson says, don't go up the Lewis and Clark route. Don't go up the Missouri River. We know a better way, a shortcut. It'll take you south of Blackfeet territory, but we can get you to the headwaters of the Columbia. So after much deliberation, Hunt leaves the Missouri, leaves the Lewis and Clark route, and with this Edward Robinson and his buddies guiding Hunt's big party, they strike off 4 months overland across what's now the Dakotas, Wyoming, and into Idaho. And they end up across the Tetons, and they end up at a small river in eastern Idaho. And Edward Robinson says, well, we think this river goes to the Columbia, and then that will take you to the Pacific. Hunt's been dawdling along the way. He's never been in the mountains before in winter. By now, it's late October. He thinks he's almost to the Pacific, when, in fact, he's in right around the Teton Mountains. And he and his party build 15 huge canoes, and they have tons of trade goods. They load these 15 canoes, and they start down this river in late October. They think it's going to whisk them to the Pacific. Well, by the ninth day on this river, they're going over major waterfalls. Canoes are smashing. Voyagers are drowning. Turns out they're on the Snake River, and they're going through the Snake River Canyon and through places like Twin Falls and Idaho Falls. And so they get stuck. It's now November. They're run out of food. 60 people, including an Indian woman with two toddlers. They can't go forward by canoe. So they split up into two smaller parties and start walking down the river. And this is, you know, right where so much of the territory where your listeners are, on either side of the Snake, through that whole arc of the Snake through southern Idaho. And the two parties walk on either side of the river. By December, they end up stuck in the depths of Hell's Canyon in snowstorms with no food, men starting to drop of weakness. They can't get out of Hell's Canyon. They can't get to the west. They're essentially just stuck. And now Hunt, who's, you know, always, that's such an interesting leadership question, of these different parties, the different leaders of these different parties, he has to decide whether to keep his party together and stay with his dying men, or split up and leave his dying men behind and try to save the rest. So it ends up being a tremendous dilemma in Hell's Canyon, and then they eventually retreat to the Boise area.
And what do they do from the Boise area?
In the Boise area, they finally find Shoshone Indians who they convince one of them, after much trouble, to guide them to what's known as the Big River, to the Columbia. And at first the Shoshone say, no, why would we do that? It's the middle of winter. You know, you're going to die going over the mountains in winter. And Hunt finally kind of shames one Shoshone into guiding him. And they end up, the whole large party, climbing over the, going westward out of Boise, northwest, and up towards that Baker, Oregon area, and over the Blue Mountains in the middle of winter. And the Indian woman, who's at this point pregnant, has a baby at the base of the mountains. The baby survives for a week, dies on top of the mountains. They struggle over the Blue Mountains. It's very difficult. Right at New Year's, they get over the top. And then they come down to the Columbia Basin, and it's much warmer, and they manage to survive and get to the mouth of the Columbia. But they're a very weakened party, and they've shown up very late at that point, which has caused all sorts of problems.
It's no fun getting over the blues in the winter now in a car.
That's right.
I can't imagine what those
guys. It was the overland party. The seagoing party had even bigger problems.
Well, yeah, tell us about that, because that's obviously, it's hard to believe, the longer journey and just as treacherous.
Well, and in the seagoing party, it was led by a young naval hero, a 30-year-old Captain Jonathan Thorne, aboard a ship that Astor had purchased, a beautiful new fast ship armed with tin cannon called the Tonkin. And the ship was, you know, packed to the rafters with all the goods you needed to start a colony, like a Jamestown-like colony. Plus, it had all these extra passengers aboard. It had French-Canadian voyageurs. It had Scottish fur traders from Canada who were the expert fur traders, and who actually Astor had made partners in his enterprise, given shares to. And it had a regular and these young Scottish clerks, kind of cheeky, educated Scottish clerks who were keeping books, and it had the regular complement of Yankee sailors and crews working for Captain Thorne. Well, you can imagine, in a way, I've described this ship as sort of a microcosm of North America at the time, you know, when the melting pot hadn't really melted, and there are all these different cultures aboard the ship splitting into different factions. So they had personality conflicts from the very start, and the first night out of New York Harbor in September 1810, Captain Thorne, under military discipline, ordered lights out at 8 o'clock, and the Scottish fur traders and the voyageurs were on deck, you know, smoking their pipes and telling stories, and they said, no, we're not ready for bed, and the captain said, yes, you are, and they said, no, we're not, and he said, yes, you're going to bed, lights out, and they said, well, actually, we own part of this ship. Mr. Astor gave us shares. The captain spun to the Scottish fur traders and said, the first man who disobeys my orders aboard my own ship, I'll blow his brains out. and things deteriorated from that point forward until the point that Captain Thorne tries to abandon the Scottish fur traders on the Falkland Islands and sail away without them.
You're listening to Peter Stark. He's the author of Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire, a story of wealth, ambition, and survival. Well, they make it around Cape Horn. How long does it take to get up to Astoria? Or what was it?
It takes about 6 months, and they stop, which it sounds odd. They stop in Hawaii, which is actually on the route when you follow the wind patterns. They stop in Hawaii to bring on Hawaiians, which actually played a big part in this colony and later colonies on the Northwest Coast. The Hawaiians were great boatmen and swimmers, knew how to raise gardens. Stopped at Hawaii, picked up 100 live pigs, 24 Hawaiians, sailed to the Northwest Coast to the mouth of the Columbia. And as you know, that's one of the most treacherous stretches of the world's oceans even today, with the Columbia Bar, a terrible sandbar with terrible currents and waves. Captain Thorne was in such a hurry to follow Astor's instructions that he arrived there in late March with a storm raging. He didn't wait for the storm to subside, but started sending longboats full of his crew or the fur traders and voyageurs to go find the channel across the sandbar. And he lost boat after boat to the storms. So he drowned 9 men that way. Finally found the channel, landed at Tonkin, got across the Columbia Bar, landed the colony, the makings of this colony, inside the mouth of the Columbia at what's now Astoria, Oregon. And then Thorne sailed north to under orders to start trading for sea otter furs on Vancouver Island. And you can imagine what personality conflicts Thorne might run into as a trader, which he was not, with the coastal Indians of Vancouver Island. And he got into an argument with one of the Indian elders, who was the chief bargainer on deck aboard the Tonkin, and Thorne took a sea otter fur and rubbed it in the chief's face and then threw the chief off the Tonkin. A more experienced fur trader aboard said, you know, that was a really bad idea. and Thorne said, in effect, well, what can these Indians do against a ship armed like this? I've got 10 cannon and 8,000 pounds of gunpowder. Well, the Indians did find a way to do something about it. And I won't give away too much of the story, but it's a very dramatic ending to Captain Thorne and his mission.
Well, let's talk about how the Astor plan worked out or didn't work out. This is really a sidelight question, but how long does it take for Astoria to get named after John Jacob Astor?
Well, it's not a side. You know, I was about to address that. It took about 2 weeks when Thorne landed his ship at the mouth of the Columbia. They unloaded all the people aboard the ship, unloaded the supplies, and started building a settlement. You know, the beginnings of a settlement. The first building they built was a warehouse. And when they laid the cornerstone for the warehouse, they said, you know, what are we going to name this place? And they chose the name Astoria. So it had that name from the very beginning. And, we could talk a little bit about the significance of all this, because, you know, it's fun to speculate, too, if it had succeeded the way Astor had hoped and Jefferson had a vision of it succeeding in a grand way.
And before you get there, Peter, help us understand what didn't happen, what did not succeed. In other words, all those grand plans of being this emporium that didn't turn out and would only be developed later as a region, or how's that work?
Well, yeah, and what happened is that there were a lot of difficulties with the leadership, you know, between Hunt's style of leadership, and he was absent a lot, and Thorne's, you know, dictatorial style of leadership. In the leadership vacuum stepped another guy who was a Scottish fur trader who was much more underhanded and less loyal to Astor. And he became the head of this fledgling colony on the West Coast, Astor's fledgling colony. And it actually, after great difficulty, it actually took hold. You know, it started to work, and more of Astor's ships started to arrive. Astor knew it would take years to turn a big profit, but he knew once it did start turning a profit, it would be huge. And they built fur posts all up and down the Columbia Basin. So it was on its way. And then what happened was, way back in the East, in Washington, James Madison is now president. The British have been harassing American shipping. Congress and Madison declare war on Great Britain. And, you know, of course, that's the War of 1812. And what that does is it renders Astoria, you know, way on the Pacific coast, so far removed from all this War of 1812, but it makes it a prize of war, a potential prize of war for the British Royal Navy, which is then the most powerful fighting force in the world. It has 600 ships, whereas the American Navy has 12, and they're not free. I don't even think all of them are in commission at that point. And the Canadians, you know, who are British subjects, the Canadian fur traders based out of Montreal also want to establish a presence on the West Coast. And, you know, they're fearing that Astor's going to get it first. So they start moving west quickly, and then they start threatening to bring British ships and their own armed warships to Astoria, which they eventually do. And the underhanded guy who's working for Astor, a guy named McDougall, finally sells out Astor's whole enterprise, Astor's whole colony out from under Astor for 30 cents on the dollar. Then it's British territory after that.
So I guess it's safe to say that no matter how prosperous John Jacob Astor might have been on the East Coast, by the time it was all over, this West Coast venture really wasn't one that was a financial success for him.
It was not a financial success. He became the primary fur trader in the whole Rocky Mountain region and the Upper Great Lakes. So he didn't, the West Coast, he left the West Coast alone. He became a very powerful merchant in other regions of the West and also New York real estate. But the whole West Coast then ended up, you know, not being really American, not being really British. It hung in a state of limbo after the War of 1812. Once the War of 1812 was finally settled, essentially there were 30 or 40 years where there was a joint occupation agreement between the U.S. and Great Britain saying, well, we both can settle there. And so this huge chunk of territory, I mean, it's, you know, in some ways it's almost the size of Europe, was hanging in limbo for 30 or 40 years. And that's one of the reasons the story is not better known, the story of what John Jacob Astor did, was because it didn't really have a very defined conclusion. You know, the way Lewis and Clark, you know, there are great heroes of Western exploration to the coast. They had a very defined mission and defined conclusion. Well, this Astor's enterprise never really resolved itself, except, you know, because this territory hung in balance until the border was finally drawn between Canada and the U.S. in the late 1840s. But what Astor's men had done in all their stumblings around through the mountains and the Snake River country, they had found what became the Oregon Trail. So they found the route, ultimately, that the settlers who did come to the Oregon country followed the route that they had explored. And they had opened American eyes to the West Coast in a way that American eyes hadn't been opened to the West Coast. And they had found, they were the first white explorers, at least as far as I know, in the Willamette Valley in Oregon. And that became, you know, the great prize piece of agricultural land that motivated a lot of Easterners who were looking for a new life to climb in their wagons and head west over the Oregon Trail to get to that Willamette Valley.
Well, Peter, we've run out of time, but I've certainly enjoyed the opportunity to talk with you about the book, and we look forward to seeing you in Boise. This is going to be great,
okay,
a great visit.
All right. Well, I've really enjoyed talking with you, Bob.
Yeah. Again, on Thursday, September 18th, Peter Stark will be at Rediscovered Books at 6 p.m. to talk about the book, Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire, A Story of Wealth, Ambition, and Survival. Peter Stark, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much, Bob.
Next week, Eric Larson, author of In the Garden of Beasts, Love, Terror, and an American Family in Hitler's Berlin. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.